and welcome to the Hoop Collective Podcast. We talk about the NBA, which we're doing at. Anybody want to guess? 12:45 a.m. on Wednesday morning. A little bit better than 4 a.m. the other day. Jackson just told us that he was up till 7:30 putting that together. And he had a meeting at 9:45. And his bosses were like, come on, Jackson, 9:45. We said 9:45. Just kidding. Joining me from Naples, Florida, staying up late with me, Bobby Marks, our front office insider.
Hello, Brian. How are you? I got to write the Suns offseason article during that game, so I was productive.
Yeah. You had the Warriors offseason article, I think I saw in my email the other day.
It's still sitting in the hopper. Yep.
Okay. And joining us from Seattle, it's Kevin Pelton, the machine.
Yeah, we'll see if that the tone is any different depending on how many rounds there are between when you wrote that, when you publish it.
I'll tell you what, there's one article that's going to need a rewrite is the Miami Heat offseason article.
No kidding. Holy Moses. Okay, so guys, you know LeBron has played against Steph and the Warriors. This is now the fifth time they've played each other in the playoffs. It's the first time he's ever actually been ahead, other than in 2016 when he won game seven with the Cavs, because the Warriors always played from ahead and the Lakers got this one. And, you know, as the game came down, I sort of was telling myself that they had to get it because it was an odd game. I like to say there's no such thing as weird games. There's only NBA games. Cause I hear people talk all the time like, oh, that was a weird game. And I go, no, it was an NBA game. NBA games are like that. But this one, I think, qualifies. And that's because our folks at ESPN Stats and Info tell us this is the first game in NBA history. How often, Pelton, do you hear something like that being said in 2023?
That's pretty rare. I mean, maybe first game in playoff history, maybe first game this season, but all of NBA history is a long time.
Yeah. And sometimes, though, and we have a couple of stats that go back to like the 90s or the 70s, but this time, the first game in NBA history where one team made 15 more three-pointers than the other and the other team made 20 more free throws. Talk about contrasting styles, Bobby. This game to me felt like, you know, there's cliche that a game feels like a heavyweight fight. And, you know, they say, I don't know anything about boxing, but they say, you know, styles make fights. This was styles make fights, heavyweight fight action in this game.
Well, and if you go by that analogy, I mean, Golden State was down in the cards and basically threw haymakers in round like 9 going into 10 to tie the game and had a chance. I mean, Andrew Wiggins basically grabbed 4 offensive rebounds and Golden State missed, I think, 3 threes on that. And I think, yeah, I mean, their difference is that free throws for the Lakers, and basically it was like a fortress guarding the paint. I mean, basically everything from Golden State came from on the perimeter. The Warriors couldn't get anything at all around the rim. Even the Curry patented floaters were rejected here. And I think for Lakers, like game one is the game you steal, right? Like that's the game, like a team who just like a Golden State team that just played Sunday afternoon, Lakers last played Friday night. Who knows if, you know, from a rest standpoint, but this is the game, you know, you lose this and who knows what happens, but you're up, as you said, you're up 1-0 and man, you got to feel pretty good about yourself.
So a couple more stats here. So Anthony Davis, okay. Anthony Davis was absolutely spectacular in this game. This is, you know, he's kind of in trouble now because, you know, this is what people want to see out of him. Maybe not these statistics, but dominating interior presence. And he was a dominating interior presence. 30 points, 23 rebounds, 5 assists, and 4 blocks. Okay. LeBron had, let's see, let me pull up the final box score because I didn't see it. LeBron didn't shoot the ball well. He had they don't have the final box score up on the NBA. I think he had like 23.
Yeah. 29 of 24 from the field, 22 points.
1 of 8 from three.
Well, that's not a surprise. 22 points, 11 rebounds, 5 assists, 3 blocks. But here's the stat I'm trying to get to. The first time teammates have gone have two teammates have gone for at least 20, 10, and 5 with 3 blocks in the same playoff game since blocks were first tracked in 73-74. So what you basically had there is the explanation for how one team played all through the interior and one team played through all through the perimeter. It was absolutely a complete interior focused domination by the Lakers. And the other thing, Pelton, you know, these stats are just so crazy. Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Jordan Poole, the first trio in NBA history. Again, first in NBA history to all have at least six threes in a game. I mean, we could go on. I mean, the first half, the Warriors made 9 more threes than the Lakers. That's a 36-point advantage on three-pointers. I remember I had this friend in college, and we would play NBA Live, NBA Live 96, and he would – he would put all 5 guards in, and I would put all 5 forwards in, and I was a stick in the mud, and he, I guess, was progressive. I thought he was a stupid dude, but he was progressive, and he would shoot threes every time down, and I would shoot layups every time down because I had big guys. And you know what I would say, Pelton, is that those games that we would play, there may have been some wagering, there may have been some cursing. I may have broken a Super Nintendo controller at one point and then had to go to Best Buy and purchase a replacement for my roommate. That might have happened. But that was kind of what this game was. One team shooting a bunch of twos, one team shooting a bunch of threes, and old school one out.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of what you're describing, and maybe this game reminds me that Don Nelson always said that the inspiration for his small ball was that the Celtics would sometimes scrimmage when he was playing for them. It would be Red Auerbach would put the guards against the bigs, and he felt like the guards always won. In this case, though, it was the revenge of the bigs. And 2 more stats. So I know we've thrown a lot out there already, but
I keep going
to talk about the paint domination. Number one, the Warriors shot 14 of 35, 40% on shots in the paint tonight. That tied for the 5th lowest in any game this season. And obviously Anthony Davis, the single biggest factor. And the 35 is not a very large attempt number because he was also a deterrent. It wasn't just that the Warriors were missing in the paint. It's also that they were just refusing to shoot there anyway. But also in terms of how remarkable it was that the Lakers won this game, the negative 15 differential in terms of threes ties the most ever for a team that has won a playoff game. The Bucks did it to the Heat in game 1 of their series back in 2021, their first round series that the Bucks swept.
Man, Bobby, what I'm thinking as I'm watching this game, so AD didn't come out in the second half and was lumbering up and down the court, although he still made a couple of plays late. LeBron, again, he came into this 6 of 36 on threes in the last series, goes 1 of 8. He's just no shot. The Warriors are starting to back off of him. He's going to get the Dylan Brooks treatment pretty soon. He's lumbering around out there. I suspected that the Lakers would try to slow the game down because even though they're a high possession team in the regular season, I felt that sort of slower and pounding favored them because it would slow the Warriors down. I got to say, like, their Lakers are up 1-0 and you got to credit them for sure. I mean, second series in a row, they go on the road and win game 1. But I don't, you know, a game every other day, I don't know if they can keep playing this way and win 3 more times.
Well, the pace, I mean, especially when they went up 14, I think it was 112-98, and Golden State went small, where they put Draymond at the 5, they took Looney out. I mean, that was like, you know, basically being at like the Indy 500, right? I mean, like, I don't know if they can, if Golden State goes to that lineup. I mean, maybe it was just because of the situation here, but that's the lineup that's going to get up and down here. And, you know, it's funny, like I'm watching the game and the one thing that stood out for me, and I'm like looking, going all the way back to like February, thinking like the impact that Jared Vanderbilt had defensively and D'Angelo Russell making shots. Like you think like that's all they gave up. That's all they gave up was a first round pick. you know, for those two guys. And Beasley hasn't played at all, and he's become a non-factor. And I'm thinking, like, and this is no disrespect to Kyrie Irving, right? Like, but I'm thinking Kyrie Irving when I'm watching this game, because things would be a lot different with this Laker team right now if, you know, Brooklyn had made the Kyrie Irving trade to the Lakers, let's say, for example, and the Lakers don't have all these other parts to this, you know, it's basically top heavy roster here. And you're just going through those different scenarios here, watching these guys, you know, the guys they acquired in the trade. You know, D'Angelo Russell made some big shots. I mean, the Vanderbilt three in the corner, right? I mean, like, and his defense on Curry for most of the game here. Those two guys you didn't have before the deadline, and they contributed, you know, mightily.
So Bobby, you mentioned the going small and how that changed the game, the pool party lineup. One of the things it did is it took Jared Vanderbilt off the court, because, you know, the Lakers just weren't confident that he could keep up with that many little guys, even though that's primarily who he's defending out there. He's got the primary defensive assignment on Steph. And I think that pretty dramatically changed things offensively for the Warriors. And I think it has to be more than just, you know, a kind of a gimmick or a desperation move, because of the fact that they were trailing. You know, the Lakers will probably have a better plan for how to try to take advantage of that lack of size when they have the ball for game two. But I thought it was crucial for the Warriors the way that the Lakers were defending. The Lakers, I thought, came out with a much better game plan tonight, were much better prepared to take advantage of the lack of shooting when the Warriors had both bigs on the court, and that pool and how well he played, that pool party lineup and how well he played sort of flipped that.
So the post-game press conferences are going on right now. I'll be interested to see if there's any complaints about the free throw disparity. It's as big as you would normally ever see. The Lakers 25 of 29, the Warriors 5 of 6. One of the things that we talked about in other series this year, and when this has been the case in the Suns series, how much, you know, getting up more shots. The Warriors got 106 shots up in this game. Now, it's going to be a little bit skewed because they basically were not fouled. So all of their shots basically counted, whereas if you get fouled, it doesn't count as a shot attempt. Guys, there are 48 minutes in a game. That means they got 2.2 shots up per minute. That's a pretty crazy rate. But I'm wondering if I know that Draymond got furious at that one off-ball foul that he got teed up on and then chewed on Ed Malloy for about 15 minutes.
I don't feel like it was that call. I think that was the toothpaste, you know.
No, I understand. But like, did you feel like it was lopsidedly called? I didn't feel like that. I don't know. I don't have a rooting interest, so maybe I missed it.
I mean, I think we expected this coming into the series. I mean, you look at what the Lakers did in terms of their free throw differential during the regular season. On the flip side, what the Warriors did, that they almost never, you know, got to the line less frequently than any other team and fouled a lot over the course of the season. So it was kind of what you anticipated coming into the series. Maybe not this extreme in terms of 29-6, but, you know, 25-6 in the competitive portion. But I don't think that the Warriors, like, if the Warriors can stay within 10 free throw attempts of the Lakers, I feel like that's a good outcome for them.
Well, and I think too, like, even when they went small, I mean, Draymond basically, you know, did nothing. I mean, he basically was the facilitator here. It wasn't like he was, you know, down low. And I think everything that went in the paint was like, it felt like Golden State was kind of shying away from contact, or, you know, flopping to make it look like they got contact. I mean, LeBron, you know, I mean, on the other hand, you know, I mean, as you guys know, I mean, full steam ahead, right? I mean, right at the rim. Same with Anthony Davis here. So, I mean, when you attempt 53 threes and you only take 6 free throws, I mean, there you go. I mean, that's,
yeah, I think you're right, Bobby, because there were a few plays where Warriors guys went in there and they ended up on the deck, but I'm not sure, you know, so, I mean, you could probably find a spot or two where the Lakers got away with a bump, but I didn't feel like it was egregious, but I'm sure there are Warriors fans coming out of Chase Center right now that feel completely differently. So we'll see if that becomes a storyline. I just don't know yet. And I'm certainly not waiting. I think one of the things, and Stan Van Gundy pointed this out on the broadcast, the Warriors really didn't seem like it seemed like Curry was off the ball a lot in this game. I guess that was maybe part of their game plan, but you know, they had Vanderbilt on him a lot and he's got size, and they for a while had trouble getting the ball to Curry. And then finally in the fourth quarter, they put the ball in his hands and he started going to work. So that's an adjustment I think that you'll see in the, in game two for sure. That with Curry with the ball in his hands more, but you know, Bobby, like the Lakers at this point, they were one of the best teams in the second half of the season. They took care of the Grizzlies in less than seven. Go up on the road, we sort of self-roasted ourselves for talking about the Lakers so much, but this is one of the reasons why we did, because they knew they were capable of this. You know, seeing what you see tonight, you know, do you think they're capable of pulling the upset again?
Oh, I definitely do. I mean, it's just a matter of like, you know, the mystique of Golden State. I mean, I think Golden State showed us in the Sacramento series, you know, when they were down 2-0, never to count them out. But I think this Laker team is a lot different than Sacramento. I, certainly with how Davis has played, and I think it's probably a little bit more balanced here, but I think we're starting to see, I mean, there's, you know, we're waiting for, well, was it, you know, just the second half of the season? Okay. You know, they played really well the second half of the season. Now you add, the Memphis series here. Now there's the body of work, you know, is starting to show that this is a team that we, you know, if we haven't already, should, you know, start considering as one of the Western Conference heavyweights here.
Yeah. Pelton, they got criticized because they beat a lot of teams that had injuries or whatever, including the Grizzlies. Well, it was a full power Warriors team on their home floor tonight.
They certainly look like a top six roster in the Western Conference to me tonight. I would say that.
I might have sent a text to McMahon and Bontemps at the end of the game that said top six roster. And I might have done that over the weekend when they beat the Kings. I don't want to reveal anything that goes on in that text chain for many reasons, but I might have said that again.
I neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the question right now is, you know, I mean, I think they're the favorites in the series at this point. I thought it was close to a toss-up coming into this.
I'm not sure. I go back, you know, Anthony Davis plays 44 minutes in game one with 3 days rest. I'm not sure about that one.
Yeah, I mean, I expect, like, one of the things I tweeted about earlier in the night in relation to the Knicks, who I'm sure we'll talk about at some point, is it's now 14 consecutive wins in the playoffs when the home team loses game one in game two. So you have to kind of expect the Warriors to make this a 1-1 series, and then it's up to the Lakers to hold serve in the next two games at home or otherwise, you know, the Warriors are right back in a situation where they have home court and the Lakers suddenly have to win on the road and only have two chances to do it. So, you know, that's kind of the way that series play out when you have home court advantage. I think there's two factors that are going to determine this. One is, to what degree the Lakers can continue this level of effort now that it's going to move to an every other night series and they don't have the rest advantage that they earned by taking care of business against Memphis in six games. And then number two is going to be how much the Warriors kind of learn from this one, because the thing that I strongly considered Lakers in six as a pick, the thing that ultimately tilted me towards Warriors in seven was suspecting that they were going to be able to come up with a game plan to, as we've seen the Warriors do so many times in the playoffs, take advantage of Jared Vanderbilt's non-shooting, take advantage of D'Angelo Russell defensively, and make it difficult for Darvin Ham to play those guys. And again, with the exception of the last 5 minutes when Vanderbilt was out, that wasn't the case tonight.
I don't think we're in for many games like this, because I just don't think they can. First off, it's a unique game in NBA history. Secondly, I just don't think that either team can keep up this pace. I just don't. And, you know, Curry didn't have as high energy today throughout the game as he normally does. And I get it, because 2 days ago he took shot 38 times. So definitely be excited to talk about this one after Thursday night when the Warriors tried to make it 1-1.
More Hoop Collective podcast after this.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call, click, Grainger.com, or just stop by. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call or click Grainger.com or just stop by. Okay, so a home team that did make it 1-1 tonight, the Knicks. This is it's complicated to read this game because Jimmy Butler obviously missed it. The Knicks were definitely playing like a desperate team. Now, I can easily just point out that Julius Randle did not play in game one. He played in game two, and he had 25, 12, and 8, and was plus 14. And that right there alone made a massive difference, because instead of getting, you know, I don't remember what the boards were in the first game. I think the Heat won the boards, but it felt like they won the boards. Having Randle out there makes a huge swing. The Knicks pound the Heat on the boards in this game, a very classic sort of Knicks style game, where they get, you know, kill them on the second chance points and sort of control the tempo because they're so good at rebounding. And that's what happened here. And it looks like Randle looks pretty good in that ankle. And I don't know when Jimmy Butler's ankle is going to be okay, Bobby, because, I know there was a concept here that, you know, because they have the time off until Friday, right? They have 2 days off after this.
They play on Saturday.
Saturday.
Yeah, Saturday so afternoon.
Right. Friday is, I have to cover the game in Philly on Friday. I better make sure I'm at that one. So they get 3 days off. So it was sort of prudence when you're up 1-0 and you have 3 days off coming out that you can give Jimmy 5 days off. But I can't assume that Jimmy's going to be okay by Saturday. That looked like a pretty hellacious ankle turn to me. So Randle coming back and looking good, I think, is a huge, I mean, obviously Jalen Brunson played better in this game. He had 30, he had his own ankle issue. He had 30 and he sort of comes out as the headliner. But to me, Bobby, Julius Randle coming back and looking like this is just as important as Jimmy Butler's own ankle issue.
No, you're right. I mean, to steal a hockey term, it felt like at the end of this game that New York was on a power play, right? Like you're just like Miami's trying to clear the zone, right? Like get the puck out of the, you know, out of the, because it was like offensive rebound after it was like, you know, five, you know, and I think it might have been a 1-point game where basically there was multiple offensive rebounds here. And yeah, I mean, the size of Miami, which has kind of been a, you know, somewhat of a hindrance for most of the year. And Miami went small too. They put Kevin Love in towards the end. Kevin had played for most of the game, but I mean, they went with the Vincent, Lowry, Bam, Cale Martin,
Duncan Robinson,
and Duncan Robinson lineup. And Max Strus had hurt his back. So they went really small here, and Miami shot making kept them in it. Right. I mean, they were up six and, but I mean, they just got decimated on the glass here. And, you know, the Randle size, the Robinson size, Hartenstein played really well. I thought, they just kind of were.
Yeah. Thibodeau trusts Hartenstein, I guess, to finish the games. It happens all the time. He's his finishing big man and he usually plays pretty well. Frankly, he's, you know, it's a pretty good, he's a pretty good trust there and he splits the minutes and usually Hartenstein gets more minutes, but Robinson was also very effective, you know, but Robinson just fouls too much. So it's kind of hard to play more minutes, but.
Well, 48% foul shooting is tough in the stretch.
Yeah. He kind of slings it or he kind of like flicks it. It's a weird, it's not a good looking shot.
Not a lot of arc.
And what New York did too, I mean, with Brunson, I mean, he hunted Duncan Robinson down. I mean, like he was like, they basically switched and he was looking for like, his eyes lit up, you know, I mean, he hit some big shots down the stretch here, but I mean, this Miami team is not going anywhere, you know, like, I mean, I know we don't know if Jimmy's going to play on Saturday or not, but still, man, like, I mean, this is going to be, they're going to go down swinging here. You know, I mean, this is a, This is an extremely tough out, but I give, you know, certainly New York, if you know, Randall stays, if he's healthy, I mean, they can go down there and certainly, they've proved it during the year, they can go down there and split. You know, I mean, is Miami going to continue making a team that I think they ranked what, like 24th and or 25th in 3-point percentage? I know they had a really good March
this year, a really good first round.
I mean, are they going to continue at this pace? I mean, that's the crazy part.
I mean, today it was really more about the volume that they got up 49 threes. And I think they kind of needed to do that because, I mean, they were able to manufacture some buckets. And I think Eric Spoelstra deserves a lot of credit for the fact that they were able to stay in this game with as little shot creation as they had. And, you know, it was, you know, layups out of timeouts, a lot of back cuts, things like that were how they were able to score besides for making threes in this game. It felt a little Celtics Sixers-y the night before in terms of the undermanned team. Obviously, they didn't have a Jimmy Butler or a James Harden scoring 45 points the way that Philadelphia had the night before because it was a way more defensive game. But it felt like that kind of like Knicks letting them hang around could cost them before they were able to pull away at the end and win. Celtics weren't.
The Heat just stitch it all together. I mean, they just, you know, they their body count is crazy. You know, they're already down Hero and Oladipo. Jimmy Butler now is out. So that's three rotation players. And then Strus, who was having a good game, hurts his back in the second half. He came back, but he wasn't quite the same. And so they're down all these bodies and they're still, you know, they're still in it in the last minute. You know, they, you know, only had 7 turnovers and they created 22 points off turnover. So that was a way they kind of closed the gap, you know, like they just, that's how they operate. That's the tone that Eric Spoelstra sets every single day of the year. He sets it, and I'm just, you know, I've been there and I've seen it. They walk the walk. They don't talk the talk, and they walk the walk. They have expectations out of everybody on their roster, and those are that they're held accountable in July. They're held accountable in November. They're held accountable in May. That's just the way they operate, and you can see how they do it. But to me, I just don't see how they win the series unless Jimmy comes back. And I don't mean just comes back, you know, suits up, but like is back playing at that level. I think it's – seeing Randall tonight, I just think advantage Knicks. Now, I thought Jimmy was cooked last year when he hurt his knee in the conference finals and like basically was able to give nothing or next to nothing in games 4 and 5. And I thought, okay, well, that's going to be for the Celtics. And then he came back and had an absolutely jaw-dropping 6 and 7. In the game 6, one of the best performances I've ever seen in the playoffs in person. So, you know, I'm not counting him out at all, for sure. He can do it, but I mean, you know, he's going to have to do it because the Knicks have a lot going for him. I mean, Josh Hart, he didn't have a good shooting night, but he had 14, 10, and 11, triple-double, and, you know, just made number of hustle plays. RJ Barrett has played better over the last couple of games. They got a lot going for him. I don't know how you see it, Pelton. You just said you sort of lean Lakers. What do you lean here?
I lean Knicks for the same reason you did. You do. I thought Knicks coming into this series, and you know the way that the Heat were able to defend them in Game 1 sort of made me start to second guess that. But this was kind of more what we expected, and obviously Randall just unlocks a lot of things, even if he doesn't necessarily provide quite as much shooting as Obi Toppin, but. You know, the shot creation that he offers, maybe a little more reliable defensively, which is an interesting thing to say about Julius Randle. If you think back to the early stages of his career, and then just what Brunson was able to do, where he felt like he was playing in traffic the entire Game 1, and for him to be able to create some space with the, you know, with the 3-point shooting off the dribble in this one, I think are the edges that, you know, if you believe in the Knicks, are what made you believe in them in the first place.
Before Randall went to New York when he was with the Pelicans, I had a high level NBA executive tell me, he's like, you just can't win with that guy on your team. He kills you so bad defensively. It's not a winning proposition. And, you know, when he signed that first contract with the Knicks, it was okay, but I think it was a pay cut, Bobby.
Well, and last year wasn't even guaranteed.
Right. Right. it ended up getting guaranteed. You know, like, I know this isn't like breaking news that Julius Randle is good, but like, Pelton is correct. there was a time where you wouldn't think about talking about him as sort of a difference-making player like this. You talk about difference-making the other direction, which is why there's, you see guys who are still in their early to mid-20s. You don't, you know, it's dangerous to give up on him because look at what he has done. So he didn't even shoot the ball well tonight. He was 8 of 18. He missed some good looks at threes. I mean, he can be better than even he was tonight. So, but I'm sure when the Heat go home with some rest, Butler notwithstanding, I think, you know, you'll see them play better. I think, you know, Lowry didn't play his best game tonight. He can play better. So we'll see there. So I want to talk a little bit about the game that I was at here in Boston last night, I guess Monday night, and setting up game two tonight, as in Wednesday night. Joel Embiid winning the MVP today. You know, we talk about the MVP all year long. We devote entire Hoops podcast to it. And then the day it's announced, we're like, oh, let's talk about these other games for a half hour first.
It's a regular season award.
Did you guys see the footage that the Sixers put out on their social feeds about when Joel found out he won the award?
I did. I mean, I was waiting for him to give a speech to thank Bontemps for the straw poll to kind of, you know.
Well,
I did. And I think that was like 2 years of emotions there, like tied into
3 years,
years into all that. It was a good one.
Well, Bontemps has a story to tell. I won't tell it for him, but he did. I think Embiid did run into him after the game. Now, granted, Embiid's in a very good mood at that point, and I think that Embiid might have asked Bontemps where he voted. So I'll let Bontemps tell that story if he chooses to. But it was kind of awkward, which is kind of odd, because the way that they had to announce this, the 76ers are on the road, and obviously there were preparations made. You know, the 76ers had to prepare to hold a press conference on Wednesday, which they are in Boston at the— It's odd that they would— I don't remember them ever announcing an MVP when the team is on the road. You know, last year, Jokic, the Nuggets season was already over and Jokic was in Serbia, and the Nuggets knew that he had won it, and they snuck over and announced it. Remember, like last year for the awards, they were doing this thing where they would have the players' teammates like surprise them with it. Like, you remember Ja surprised, or Ja like left the Sixth Man of the Year award at Bane's house, or Bane gave it to Ja. I don't remember what it was. And, you know, they would do it. Well, now they're like surprising people, I guess. And so, or like, you know, doing it this way. And so, like, Embiid was pretty sure, I think, that he was going to win, and the Sixers were making plans. But I honestly don't think that they really knew for sure until they announced it on TV. And that's why Embiid was so emotional when he saw it. And so it's very unusual that a team would be on the road in the playoffs when a player won the MVP. I don't know if that's ever happened before, because it's always announced when the player is home. So as a result, the entire 76ers team was together. And it was kind of like a Selection Sunday moment. They were in there in a ballroom at their hotel here tonight to watch— not, I mean, I'm sure they let them stay and watch the games if they wanted, but they were in the ballroom to watch the MVP announcement, and Embiid was sitting in the front row, or, you know, by him, kind of off by himself. And what would have happened if they said he's Nikola Jokic? But it's just awkward that Bobby, do you think Red Auerbach is rolling over in his grave that somebody is accepting an MVP award inside the TD Garden that's not a Celtic?
I thought they could have— I know they announced that they were going to do it on Tuesday, but I would have thought, you know, hey, who won it, why not just do it on Friday?
Because they needed to do it on TNT.
Yeah.
And they couldn't do it like right before a game that Embiid was playing in.
Yeah. I mean, somebody had to have been tipped that he was winning, because you're not going to do all that.
Yeah. That. We were all pretty sure. I mean, everybody had made their plans and everything. Like, there's extra personnel for the 76ers here. You know, I think Embiid's family and friends were in, but I still think there was— it was not like 1000% like super duper confirmed until the very end.
Well, I mean, especially that, you know, I mean, I know, and it is a regular season award. I mean, how great Jokic is playing in the playoffs too. So yeah, I mean, the votes went in before the playoffs started here. And of course, I mean, when you don't, when you've been close the last, you know, 3 years here, you always have that doubt, right? I mean, like, you know, we can go straw polls all we want and, you know, Vegas could say you're the favorite, but who knows? I mean, I know people were counting, but who knows?
So LeBron, Jackson just told me, I hadn't seen the results yet, but Jackson told me this was the first time in LeBron's career he didn't get a single vote for MVP. And when I say single vote, not first place, but anything in the top five. And you know, they had that, he had that run where he was in the top three for like a decade. Pelton, I will say this, the Bontemps poll wins again, correctly forecasting the winner. Do you agree with the result?
I was one of the, I think there was maybe a dozen or 15. I forget which was Giannis and which was Jokic. I was one of the Jokic voters for the third consecutive year. I talked about that on the Low Post at the end of the regular season. But, you know, I do think from the sense of are both of these guys deserving? And, you know, would it be a tough break for Embiid if he had not won an award and Jokic had kind of claimed all of these? Absolutely. I didn't personally factor that into my voting, but I think some people surely did. And I think, you know, that's a reasonable thing to do because, you know, this is part of someone's historical legacy, and Embiid hadn't gotten that level despite playing at an MVP caliber the last few years.
Well, you know, I was a big advocate of Embiid for MVP last year and voted for him. And this year I voted for Giannis. So 2 years in a row, I voted for the guy who didn't win. Was my vote wasted? I don't know.
More Hoop Collective podcast after this.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavily on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liquor, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Vivid Seats wants you to get to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seat Rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code HOOP. That's code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. As for the game, Bobby, I felt like I was transported back to last year here in Boston when I attended so many Celtics games, particularly in Boston, where they kept losing games, where they would look so good for so long and then lost their focus. And I thought Doc Rivers outcoached Joe Mazzulla. It didn't come all down to coaching, but Doc's maneuvers at the end of the game, Mazzulla's refusal to double team Harden, who was like really the only serious offensive threat on the floor at the end. Several possessions that the Celtics ran where they just completely didn't have focus, including their last possession where, I mean, I don't think he drew the play up for Marcus Smart, but Marcus Smart broke the playoff. And, you know, when the player does that, you know, it's sort of on the coach for not setting the standard to not do that. Very much of a fumble by the Celtics, Bobby, to not win that game without Embiid in a game where they made 14 of their first 15 shots and were still shooting like over 65% at the start of the third quarter.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's almost like the Atlanta series. I mean, I think you can get away with it against a Hawks team when you blow game five without DeJounte Murray and, you know, have to hang on in a game six. I think it's, you know, there's kind of a pattern developed. I mean, if maybe the pattern already developed last year in the, you know, in the Golden State, in the Golden State series here, but lack of focus, you know, certainly a different coach here. Jaylen Brown was, you know, basically ineffective in the fourth quarter. And you didn't adjust to, I mean, basically Harden was really the only guy. I mean, you know, certainly Tyrese Maxey had played well, but Harden was the guy. If they were going to win, it was going to be based on, you know, riding on Harden's shoulders here. And you're right. I mean, the play at the end, you know, certainly you could say that Marcus Smart, broke that off, but you can't lose a game one like that. You can't lose a game one at home with Embiid on the sidelines.
Yeah, as Bontemps highlighted in the low post, like they didn't lose it at the end. It was the fact that they let it get to the end and be that close was really the unacceptable part of it against, you know, a shorthanded Philly team that was struggling to the degree they were defensively. My buddy Mark Hobner tweeted that it was the fifth consecutive Celtics underwhelming playoff series. And I do feel like it's a little different than last year, because last year it was the focus element and the turnovers, as you mentioned, Bobby, but it wasn't the playing down to opponents to the degree, because this was against good teams. Yeah. Miami in the conference finals was a good team. The Warriors were a good team. Not that the Sixers aren't, even without Joel Embiid, a good team, but there's still a team that you should take care of business against in that situation. And it's just kind of like, well, we're going to flip the switch at some point in the fourth quarter and figure things out. And that's a really dangerous way to play.
They almost did. The Sixers, by the way, didn't get a free throw until like 9 minutes or maybe, no, 1 minute left, I think, in the first half, I think was what it was. No, there was no free throws in the game until 1 minute left in the first half. And the Sixers didn't get their first free throw until midway through the third quarter.
It was the ultimate let them play. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just, earlier we talked about, weird analogies, in about games, but you hear all the time, this felt like a playoff game. You hear a regular season game that's particularly spirited and the crowd's into it. You hear, oh, that felt like a playoff game. This was the opposite. This felt like a regular season game. There was almost no juice in the building. A few times they got into it. This guy in front of me in Boston, popped a blood vessel in his eye because he was standing up in the fourth quarter. There was 6 minutes to go. The Celtics are in a dogfight, and he was standing up, trying to cheer. And one of the ushers came over and asked him to sit down because he was blocking the view of his other people behind him. And he screamed at the usher, "It's a playoff game. It's a fourth quarter of a playoff game. You're telling me to sit down?" And yeah, because nobody was standing up. And it's not a commentary on the Boston fans. It's a commentary on the style of the game. The game, I think if anything, you want to give an excuse for or a reasoning why Joel Embiid's the most valuable player is Joel Embiid not playing in the game made the game feel less than, but of course it wasn't. The other thing is the Celtics kind of had that magic number last year, or tragic number, of 15 turnovers. They were 13-2 in the playoffs when they had less than 15, was it 15 or less than 15, something like that. And if they had 16 or whatever, they were 2-1-8. Including game six against the Warriors, where I think they had 22 at the very end. And the turnover where Tyrese Maxey got the pick six interception touchdown, whatever you want to call it, was their 16th turnover. And they did get away with a couple of high turnover games in the last round against the Hawks. So it's not quite that, but that it was like looking back in time on that. And Bobby, I got to tell you, I wrote a story about this. I don't know how it came off on television, but being in the Arena Bowl when that play happened where Maxey got the pick six, it was a surreal moment because it was a very frustrating possession for Celtics fans because the Celtics couldn't get anything done. They pump fake like four times. Brogdon throws the ball to Maxey, and then the shot clock buzzer goes off. I watched the replay. I went frame by frame as much as I could. Maxey caught the ball with 0.1 seconds left on the shot clock. It was the correct application of the rule. But when the shot clock buzzer rang, the entire building relaxed. I think only one other player on the court even moved, and it was a member of the Celtics. I think it was Paul Reed, maybe, or somebody who started running. And he goes and scores. And I didn't comprehend that they counted the basket until they put it on the scoreboard. there was this incredibly important clutch basket that happened that changed the whole game with 28 seconds left, where literally nobody in the arena reacted. And Maxey, acting him like not understanding the reaction of the crowd and everybody else, he kind of turned around and looked behind him. And he told me after the game, he almost picked the ball up at the foul line. You know, it was like a football game where you see like a ball that's obviously not a fumble. Like, you know, it's like a screen pass and it's incomplete. And the defensive lineman, like, you know, he was taught to play to the whistle or whatever. And so he picks it up and runs it, you know, 60 yards, and everybody just watches him do it. And, you know, everybody knows it's not a touchdown, but in this case, it counted. And I think that entire play was indicative of the way the Celtics approached the fourth quarter.
Well, it almost felt like the whole, like, it's one of those plays where, like, everyone froze, including the fans, right? It was just like, there was basically like, you know, 20,000 people froze except for one player who reacted to that. And yeah. And it almost, it had an, you know, certainly an impact on their next possession and like that play. And then like the one thing, and I mentioned it, you know, the ability of Paul Reed to make four free throws in a row and not even like clanking it. Like, you mean, I was expecting at least one clank. The funny thing is too, is like, you know, people say like, you know, like sometimes against James Harden said, well, you know, James Harden had a great game and all you're talking about is Paul Reed. Well, I'm talking about Paul Reed because basically he's a reserve and probably the biggest spot of his career. And basically we went all net on four free throws. And basically, and that's after I didn't see the play. I read that, you know, with Doc Rivers, I guess PJ Tucker had chewed him out on a couple Boston offensive rebounds. That Doc had said that it went to almost to the extreme in the huddle, which, you know, for a young player like that, you know, to kind of keep his composure is saying something.
Elton, did they show that on the broadcast?
The huddle?
Yeah, where PJ tore into Paul Reed.
I don't remember it. Also, I think Okay. Our standards for what the extreme is in a huddle have changed since the last day of the regular season.
Fair point.
That's true.
So after the game, Doc's like, well, I'm sure all of America saw that in the huddle, but, you know, PJ really ripped him a new one. And, you know, it was really mature of us to all move on from that. He like made a big deal of it. Like, because PJ was screaming at him about giving up rebounds. The Celtics got like three offensive rebounds in like two possessions. But America hadn't seen it. I mean, later on, the video came out on social and it probably would have anyway, but like, you know, Doc just assumed that the broadcast showed it and it didn't. And so like when he said it, I was like, what? I don't know what you're talking about. And I went online and like looked on my phone. And I didn't see anybody talking about it. Doc kind of outed what had happened. And so anyway, yeah. So Harden, before we go, Harden obviously was brilliant. Now, the one thing that I came away from after talking to the Sixers after the game was that they knew for days that Joel was not going to be able to play in game one. And let me just say that he is making progress. He's worked out the last 2 days. Today he had a workout where he did some running. And I think if he feels okay on Wednesday after that workout, that they may seriously consider playing him. They also are up 1-0 with the potential of giving him two extra days rest. And they need him for the series, so they may not, but I do think he is making progress. But they knew Pelton for you know, days, 4 or 5 days, Joel was not going to play in game one, and they had all this practice time. And Doc and the players said it, like, they were able to like install some stuff in practice, particularly, you know, Harden had really struggled shooting in the paint and shooting two-pointers against Brooklyn. I mean, it wasn't a hard series for them, but he didn't have a good interior scoring series. And so they changed some stuff for him, like changed some of the angles of the screens they were setting. And he also came in knowing that he was going to be, you know, Houston James. And it made a huge difference. I don't know whether you can count on it happening more than once. He had his career high, but in a strange way, you know, and again, Bobby, you mentioned this earlier about the Lakers earning their days off. The Sixers earned their days off and they were able to use it to prepare for game one without Embiid. And I actually kind of think Doc said that the practice that they had Saturday was like one of the best practices of the year. It's like, okay, we got to a good spot. We know what we're going to do. And I actually think Doc isn't 100%. Like, I think he's okay if he has to sit and beat for one more game, because I think he likes the rhythm that they're in, and he'd rather stick with this rhythm and try to play with it again and make sure Joel is better with the extra couple of days, as opposed to bringing Joel back early.
Well, you look at the track record of Doc Rivers teams in recent history, like, they tend to play their best when they're undermanned. Like, you know,
that's
obviously
what that's what someone from the Celtics told me. They were like, Doc simplifies his game plans and coaches his best games when he's missing guys.
The other thing I'll say before turning it over to Bobby is, like, a lot of people said we saw Houston James Harden with that game, which in terms of the step back threes and some of the bursts, like the play where he got to the bucket when kind of Jaylen Brown was playing him to go to the middle and he was able to get to his right hand and get a layup. But also, you mentioned the mid-range shooting, and there was a bunch of those in that game, which we would never have seen from Harden in Houston. So that's kind of a unique performance from James Harden, blending some of what he's done this season with what we saw in Houston.
Well, and I just look at, I mean, you've already stolen game one. I mean, you're basically dealing with house money going into game two, right? Similar kind of what Miami had in New York, going into New York. And then, you know, after, you know, I mean, once, if he plays Friday, let's say, I mean, now you're playing basically every other day up until there's a little bit of a gap between game six and seven, which is a Thursday, Sunday. But, like, I'd be surprised. I mean, even if he had a good workout, that, I mean, you know, and they, if you, you know, worst case scenario, they come home tied 1-1, that you're saving him for that Friday, because the turnover, because you go Friday and then Sunday's a 3:30 game.
That's right.
So it's a quick turnover there.
Yeah, which is why Doc said if it's 50-50, won't be 50-50. We'll probably be don't hold, don't play him. But I do think he's made progress. So we'll see. One thing I expect to see is more Jaylen Brown. Jaylen Brown started the game 6 of 7 and then ended the game with 10 shots. 6 of 7 in the first quarter and ended the game with 10 shots. Tatum had a big game, but the shot imbalance was way in his favor. And yet down the stretch, the ball wasn't in his hands. So I expect to see Jaylen Brown more involved in game two. But that, now, just like this Lakers series with the road team winning, I think we're in for a long series. And I also think, and Miami, New York. And I also think that the minute load is going to be big in this series. Well, the minute load being asked of, you know, those Philly players, you know, add up, you know, and even the Celtics players, because Mizzou's got one of the deepest teams in the league and he didn't use his bench. And Tatum, I think, barely came out in the second half, and Tatum at the end of the game didn't have the same pop. So we'll see. But all right. Thank you for staying up late with us, guys. And we got some Kraken series. We didn't get to the Suns series. They're taking a needed break. Suns Nuggets. I should say the Nuggets series. They're up 2-0. We'll get to that later. They're taking a break. McMahon went home. So you know that, you know, McMahon's working hard when he goes home in the middle of a series. Just kidding. All right. Thank you for listening to the Collective Podcast. Thank you to Bobby. Thank you to Pelton. Thank you to Jackson, our producer. Thank you for listening. We will talk to you later this week.
Real quick, what's the easiest choice you can make? Window seat over middle? Taco Tuesday over salad? What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/hoop, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/hoop now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/hoop.